Lord, now may the words of my mouth and may the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. When I was a kid, I sometimes went to revivals at my cousin's church, where the pastor would end the service by saying, "Now I want every head bowed and every eye closed," and we would all bow our heads, and we would all close our eyes, and the organist would begin to play the hymn, "Just As I Am." And then the pastor would say, "If you were to die tonight," and little 9-year-old me would be struck with terror. I can still remember my hands clutching the pew in front of me. But the pastor would press on. "If you were to die tonight, do you know for a fact that you would go to heaven?" And we would all have to sit there for a moment with our heads bowed and our eyes closed, stewing on that question. And then the pastor would say, "If you don't know for a fact that you would go to heaven, then I want you to raise your hand." And one time, my cousin elbowed me. I was not super happy that my cousin thought I was going to hell. But the real shocker for me was that after the service was finally over, we all walked out of the church and acted like everything was absolutely fine. For 9-year-old me, things were not fine. How are things supposed to be fine after you've been sitting there thinking about your death and what happens next? How are you supposed to keep living like normal after you've confronted, truly confronted, your own mortality? To be honest, that question has never quite let me go. Not the question about knowing for a fact what comes after death, but the question about how to live once you've faced the reality of your own death. Begin with the end in mind. I first read that pithy bit of advice half my life ago in Stephen Covey's best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm seeing nods, so I know some of you have read it too. It's the second habit: begin with the end in mind. It's the habit of envisioning where you want to end up, so that you can then align or begin now to align your choices and actions with that end where you want to end up. The reason that habit, above all others, has stuck in my head all these years is not so much due to the advice itself, begin with the end in mind, but to the exercise that Stephen Covey invites readers to do in support of that habit, the funeral exercise. Or we could call it the "if you were to die tonight" exercise. Covey invites you to imagine yourself at your own funeral. There you are, lying in your casket. You're dead, but strangely enough, you can hear what people say about you. Your family, your friends, your colleagues. What are they saying about you at the end of your life? And now the more pressing question: what do you want them to say about you? That's the funeral exercise, imagining not just your death, but what you would like people to say about you, to remember about you when you're gone. And then begin with that end in mind. Make choices now that line up with that end. But if you know you're going to die, and let's face it, we all are, and we all know it, if you know you're going to die, maybe what others say about you when you're gone is not the most important thing. Maybe what you say to other people before you go is more important. Maybe what you do to or for other people is more important than what they'll say about you. When I was in the hospital, critically ill a few years ago, and not certain I was going to make it out alive, this was what pressed upon me most. Not did I know for a fact that I would go to heaven, and not would people say nice things about me when I was gone. What concerned me most was, would the people I loved the most be all right? Would they be taken care of? Would they know from me the things they needed to know? Would my dad be okay? Would my husband and kids be all right? Had I done everything I could to take care of them beyond myself, beyond my end? And what last words should I share with them? My hopes, my best advice, some instructions about when the pets should be fed and how much, the passwords to all my accounts. What's the most important thing to say, to do, to and for the people we love? Jesus knew the importance of saying the right things to the people he loved before he left. He knew he was going to die, and quickly, it was coming soon, it would be brutal. He knew the cruelty he faced. He knew the terrible devastation his disciples were going to face. And on the last night of his life, when his own heart was surely shredded with grief and pain, he spoke to them so tenderly, saying, "Little children, I am with you only a little longer, and where I'm going, you cannot come. I give you a new command, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another." This, of all things, was what he wanted, what he needed for them to know after he was gone. Not a belief, not a doctrine, not what they should know for a fact about anything, not advice about the right way to worship or the best way to serve him, not even instructions for spiritual growth through prayer, Bible reading, but this: love one another. And it's so easy to hear those words in a general, generic way. I mean, who does not agree? Who does not agree with love of all things? How is that life advice? At least begin with the end in mind comes with a nifty little funeral exercise. But love one another? That's almost bland. But Jesus says these words to his friends mere moments after he and Judas have exchanged words about how Judas is about to betray him. And Jesus has said to Judas, "Do quickly what you're going to do. And Judas immediately leaves to go betray him. He says this mere moments after facing the betrayal. And then, mere moments after he says these words about love, he will be telling Peter that Peter is going to deny him 3 times. His command to love one another is wedged between betrayal and denial, just like his life is. That makes his new command not bland, but radical. Facing the devastating truth of how much harm those closest to him can and will do to him, he still says, "This is the way." Love. Vulnerable love. Life-giving, life-spilling love. You know it's still the season of Easter, and yet this is not a resurrection appearance. This is not some happy story of Christians telling the good news. No, Jesus is staring at his own death, which will happen in a few hours. And isn't it something that in the middle of the Easter season, the lectionary scriptures invite us to reflect on this story from the deepest part of Lent? In his poem, Little Gidding, T.S. Eliot wrote, "What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. The end we start from is a tomb, not our own, but the one that was meant for Jesus, the one where his body was laid, the one the women found empty, the one that was meant to capture him, to lock in this life-spilling love, the one that was meant to be the end, but was actually the beginning. In Jesus, death and life are not the binary we think of them as. Love, real love, radical, self-giving love, can feel like a death. And sometimes what feels like death can actually be the beginning of new life and even new community, new relationship. This has been a hard week for a lot of us and for a lot of people in our country. A draft decision leaked by the Supreme Court overturning abortion rights has people angry and fearful, not just over what it means for reproductive choice, but over what it might mean for other reproductive rights and for LGBTQ rights. And for gay marriage, I've even seen some calling for, ultimately, Christian prayer back in schools, a decision made in the 1960s. And a lot of people feel afraid and betrayed and denied. It's been a hard week for many of us in other ways, too, which means it is an important time, a perfect time, really, to realize that love one another is not a platitude. It is a command. And Jesus gives it in the context of facing evil himself. When the actions of others were hateful, suspicious, violent, he chose love, and he invited, even commanded, his friends to do the same. And he called it a new command, which is strange because it is the oldest invitation and command in our story, in our scriptures. Love, love one another. Maybe it feels like a new command because we have to keep choosing it. We have to keep choosing it in new ways, new hard ways that feel like death, but make us new. Jesus even goes so far as to tell his friends, "By this, everyone will know you are my disciples if you have love for one another. By this, everyone will know." They will know what God's own heart looks like. They will know that what God wants most of all is that we all feel loved, not judged or shamed or punished, but loved, not angry or alienated or afraid, but loved. This is what Jesus wants the world to see about who God is. And this is how they will see it: by our love. By our love for one another. And it is clear that we have not done a very good job at this. And if it was not already clear before this week, it has been made abundantly clear in recent days. Because so many Christians believe that opposition to Roe v. Wade is the only possible Christian stance. And that it, not love for one another, it is a litmus test for what it means to be Christian. And because so many who don't consider themselves to be Christian also believe that is the only Christian stance, they often see Christians as trying to control everyone else and to make everyone else live by our beliefs. And then the hateful rhetoric that gets spewed as some kind of pro-life stance does not help our case for love. This week, after I shared my own faith-based convictions in support of reproductive choice, I had a woman say to me in utter astonishment, "God bless you, but I'm confused. You seem to be an open-minded Baptist. I've never known one." I told her she just hadn't met the right ones yet. And she told me that made her hopeful, but that she had known a lot of Baptists. Her grandfather was a Baptist preacher, and she had been in Baptist churches all her life until recently, when she stopped going to church at all because of what she was experiencing there. She told me, "Many Baptists are good people. But the ones that she had known have now become hateful and angry, suspicious because of conspiracy theories, and they scared her to death. And they apparently scared her all the way out of church and Christian community." She is someone that we, the church, ought to be loving the way Jesus loved, unconditionally, unstintingly, wholeheartedly. But the hard part is that all those awful other Baptists she was telling me about, we're somehow supposed to be loving them that way too. "By this, they will know you are my disciples." And all those other Christians who say the most awful, horrible, horrible things and make us all look bad, Jesus says, "Love one another. By this they will know you are my disciples. And I will confess, I do not know how. Truly, it's beyond me to love people who are so difficult and whose rhetoric and actions impugn me and judge me and also somehow make me look bad to others. It's beyond me. I can't do it." But on the last night of his life, Jesus told us how to do that too. He said, "As I have loved you," which means we are not on our own in this. We're not out here just doing our best to love and love and love out of our own resources and decisions, our mental choices to just do things right and just love until we're exhausted and run dry. No. "As I have loved you," he said, Jesus has invited us into himself, into God's own heart, where all love begins, indeed where all life begins, in God's own heart, which means we don't have to manufacture it. We don't have to manufacture love out of our own small hearts. We just have to lean into that big heart holding all of us. As we heard in the final vision in Revelation this morning, "See, I am making all things new. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life." And we who are so thirsty only need to realize that the supply of love and life is available to all of us. Even when we are exhausted, it is inexhaustible. Even when we feel like we are at our end, it never ends. One day, we will be at our end. And what will matter most then is actually what matters most now. Love one another.